The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll celebrate the best of the Best of Our Knowledge in 2024. We'll visit a former pig barn that is serving as a temporary home to the largest collection of popular music in the world. We'll spend time at the intersection of music and evolutionary theory, and we'll learn how children's ideas are brought to life in glass. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. As we welcome 2025, on today's show, we're looking back at the best of the best of our knowledge in 2024. One of my favorite segments came from a visit to the Archive of Contemporary Music. The collection, that includes millions of recordings and pieces of memorabilia, was temporarily relocated from New York City to a barn in a rural corner of the Hudson Valley. I met with founder B. George to explore the archive.
I am looking at Disraeli Gears by Cream. I'm looking at Queen, A Night at the Opera. I'm looking at David Bowie, Hunky Dory, and Patti Smith, Horses. This is quite a collection just even on this wall.
Maya Angelou, when she was a babe, signing Miss Calypso for me. And she was like a hoot. She was like a little bit thicker than she is in that photo and a little bit wobbly. And she held it up and sort of in her shaky hands and said, "My dear, I haven't seen this record in 50 years," in her majestic voice, which is quite wonderful.
Just this wall alone is something to drool over if you're a record nerd. But what can you tell me about this whole space and this archive?
First, I want to tell you that the David Bowie, David signed that for me, and then he decorated it with glitter for me, which was very nice, right?
That's incredible.
So, you know, and it's the first a lobby card signed by Jimi Hendrix's band. So do you remember what lobby cards were when they used to hand them out at shows to get you to come to the next show? So and of themselves, they're quite valuable. That's from an early show at the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit when Hendrix was really first making a first tour of the country. But it's so many wonderful things. John Travolta signed it, a whole bunch of Saturday Night Fevers for us, and so we could auction them off. But probably the rarest one would be this, which is a first pressing, white label copy, British first Rolling Stones record, and it's signed by the whole band, including Brian Jones, okay, which he doesn't sign at all anymore. So it's, and this is our favorite story about Keith Richards. This is slightly obscured or greatly obscured by dog urine, which it was in a pile of newspapers that the dog had been peeing on the corner for about 10 years. So this was found in a house in Boston area that was sinking from the weight of the records. And so we rescued 125,000 records out of that space. And then nice test pressing of Hotel California signed by all of the Eagles. So it's really, really amazing stuff. My first record I got signed, Lolita, when I snuck into a theater in Youngstown, Ohio, and had it signed for me. And I'm not a record collector anymore. I had about 47,000 records and gave them all to the archive. So
B, tell me about how the archive came to be. I understand we're in a temporary space right now, but what are the origins of the whole story here?
Oh, it's a long, strange story. Okay, so that's part of it. I had 47,000 records, and I got them through a series of strange incremental steps, one of which was I had worked with and put out the first record by an artist named Laurie Anderson. So this is the drawing of Oh Superman that Laurie made for the label. And I was also put out experimental recordings. I came to New York in 74 on a scholarship from the Whitney Museum, the Independent Study Program, to be an artist. Laurie and I ended up teaching together for a group of high school kids, like, you know, capital A art. And then after that, started playing around more with sound. And then I put out a book called Volume, which is the first punk discography. And it's like 700 pages. We can show you. It's called The Bible. It's sort of a major work that everybody sort of emulates in a lot of ways because it was done in its own time. So this is sort of one thing that I've always been interested in, is learning about the music and when it's actually happening, as opposed to doing it, you know, like what Harvard starts a hip hop section in 2007. It's a little late, you know. So we try to do things when it happens. So we have great techno sections. We have all, as music happens, we try to collect it. So I did this. I did Laurie's recording, and then I started working with a DJ in London for the BBC named John Peel. So everywhere I went, people were giving me records because they either wanted to be in the book, they wanted me to produce another record, or they wanted me to play their record on John Peel's show.
So you kind of became a point person in a way at a scene when music was really exciting and changing a lot.
Yeah, completely ignored music, I would say.
All
right.
In a way, back then, but now.
Now, yeah. You put all, well, and then I had all these recordings, and they were basically hip hop, punk, art and experimental, and reggae. Okay? Nobody wanted them. I tried to give them away because that most libraries of the time were focusing on classical and also, or a little bit ethnic, a little bit American music and folk music. But nobody wanted this newer stuff at the time. And that's literally everybody. We tried to give it away. And so I had someone come to me with this book and say, why don't we save this stuff? And that's sort of what started it. And it's really funny too, because the first version, which came out before this one, again, this is 200 some pages. So many people sent me records, the second one becomes 700 pages, right? That's how much stuff was pouring in. But what's really funny is Tim, who's just started working here 3 years ago, he ordered this from me when he was 15.
From you directly. So did you put this in the mail yourself, probably?
Yeah, oh no, we sent him a postcard saying it was sold out and would get him the next one as soon as we could. And he has the postcard, which is so hilarious that it's been, you know, I'm just too old. That's all. It's that simple. But again, so much stuff. I'm going to show you some things that are so remarkable.
I just want to point out, too, is we're looking at a wall, which someone might see if they go to a record store, maybe not everything autographed and signed, but you'd see a wall of the big records, the hits, the rare stuff on the wall, and then you'd see shelves below. And in this, what looks like an old barn, it almost looks like
a
record
store.
A piggery.
Yeah, that's one of the doors.
Off to our left.
Those are the first Sun recordings.
Wow. And below that, just U-Haul boxes.
Yeah, and
I'm guessing have records in them.
Right, they all have records, yes. And again, and those are the first five Elvis singles at the top. We have a lot of things. Johnny Cash had come through at one time when we were in New York City, and he'd signed a lot of his records for us, as did Jerry Lee Lewis. So, yeah, I think we could say that honestly, most of these records aren't that rare. But they're all in perfect condition, and they're all signed. And that's, I think, something that, I like the idea that the artists signed the records and that had touched it, and it's something that's important to them.
So you started with 47,000 records.
Yeah, exactly.
How many are in the collection right now?
We think it's a little over 3 million. And it's all, I mean, there's lots of CDs also. It's not just LPs. It's not just vinyl. There's a lot of cassettes. There's a lot of CDs. There's a couple 8-tracks that are quite wonderful. We'll show you some of those. There are a couple cylinders, and then all of our 78s we send off to be digitized with the Internet Archive in San Francisco. They do the Wayback Machine, and they also have digitized our books for us. So you can go online and read, I think, about 3,000 now of our music books.
When did you have the decision to go from collecting and cataloging to creating an archive, a preservation of physical media?
Well, it may sound weird. I'm not really a collector. I don't have any records in my house. They're all here. It was more always about, like you said, the cataloging. And I think that was sort of like what the artwork I was doing. I'd done a piece that was in the Whitney Kids had a show at the museum, and it was basically a catalog of lines. So I had just been drawing pencil lines from different pencils, and they put them all in the library card boxes like you would see in an old-fashioned wooden boxes in the library. And it's sort of, that was my interest, was like knowing where things were or what the difference was between different things. Not so much. And then I liked music. So it all sort of came together. And mostly I liked the idea of, like I said, the way, working with Laurie and what was going on at the time. New York was really amazing in the, I guess, from 75 to 77. Nobody who was in the scene was famous. Everybody, there was only one place to eat Lower Manhattan. You know, it was Dave's Lunch on Broadway and Canal. And that was it. And I lived in an area that later became, we couldn't afford a loft in Soho because it was like $100 a month. So we went to Washington Market, which later became Tribeca. But there were four or five clubs right there. Then you would go up, so you could hear, like at Tier 3, you could hear experimental music and punk. Then you'd go uptown to the Bronx or to Harlem, and you could hear hip-hop. Then you can go to Studio 54, and then to an after-hours club like Save the Robot. So it was like a lot of things could happen all at once, and everybody ended up pretty much at Dave's Lunch because there was no other place to go. And nobody had a handler. Nobody had an assistant to keep you away from them. So it was a really interesting time.
It wasn't controlled.
Yeah, by anybody. Nobody knew what was supposed to happen. They were just doing things. And I think that's a little bit different now. Quite a bit different. But let me show you a couple other things. Here's one of our favorites. These are Bone records. So these are from out of Russia, printed on X-ray film.
Is that an elbow?
Yeah. and this is a Howlin' Wolf record.
Wow.
So, because we collect and focus a lot on blues material.
So was this something that was done at the time with Howlin' Wolf in the 50s and 60s?
No. This is something that came out of all the leftover machines from World War II, where people would do recordings at the docks and send it off to their loved ones overseas who were fighting in World War II. So this happened all over Europe and all over America. So all of these machines after the war were just sitting around. They were like lathe cutting recording machines. But in the Soviet Union had banned rock and roll. Therefore, people were bringing in albums and cutting versions that could be sold. And so this is what happened. So somebody had, one guy had a record and he played it to death, and they cut hundreds and hundreds of these. And the most readily available material was X-ray film. So this happened, and so these are called Bone records, and it's quite nice. We have a couple of these, but this isn't like our favorite. And there's books about it now, and it's really become a big collector's item. I mean, that's part of the problem with all of this, is that things that you love become commodities, and they're for sale, and the price goes up and down. Like Elvis is down, the Misfits are up. You know what I mean? Because of what contributes to the next stage of music, right? So the Beatles are unimportant. Brian Eno is really important, or Bill Nelson. The way things are mixed, the sound of things, takes over from the fame of the artist, or even the quality of an artist.
Not to mention that vinyl record collecting right now is hot.
Right. And it'll disappear again. But it's permanent. I mean, we're prejudiced. We believe that the best way to preserve sound is on a vinyl disc.
Why is that?
Well, CDs have a couple problems. One, they're on metal, so they oxidize. Okay? Two, the players won't be made. And that's the main problem. How are you going to play it when the chips are gone? So anything mechanical has a better chance of surviving, we believe, than something that's electronic or digital.
B. George is the founder of the Archive of Contemporary Music in New York. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. I spoke with several authors in 2024. One of my favorite conversations was with Miriam Pelinen, a music theorist and lecturer at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We spoke about her book, Theorizing Music Evolution. The book examines conversations between evolutionists Herbert Spencer and Charles Darwin.
I want to go back back to Spencer and what you wrote about Spencer's earworm and when the song gets stuck in your head. And this is something that Spencer spent a lot of time thinking about. And he talks about, you point out his writings about how to defeat an earworm by listening to other music to triumph over the music that's stuck in your own head. But why was that significant to Spencer, and why did he obsess over it?
Okay, well, it's important to remember that Spencer is a kind of armchair philosopher.
Okay.
He was not doing archaeological research, and he didn't actually read that much either. He was mostly, you know, attending the salon, talking to other philosophers, and then sitting in his chair and theorizing. So for him, his own experiences are very important to how he thinks about evolution. And he had a love for music. He wasn't a musician. Like, he didn't learn to play instruments, but he loved music. He often wrote about how music helped him feel better if he was feeling nervous. He had many nervous syndromes. He talked about music soothed that for him. And he had many earworms. He often talked about having songs stuck in his head. And one of the things that made him think was, why do I have this something that's playing in my head on its own? I'm not controlling it, and I can't stop it, even if I really want to. So what does that mean? And for him, what that meant was something about subjectivity, something about selfhood. Who am I? What do I think? Where do I stop and my environment begins? And one of the most important things about Spencer's philosophy as a whole is he's very interested in relationships, or what he calls correspondence. And he started to theorize about a subjectivity that was always already in correspondence with the other. So the earworm is the perfect example for him of the porousness of himself, the fact that he's always already interpenetrated with others. And whether those others are ideas, environments, people, books, they're coming in and out constantly. There's a correspondence or a negotiation that's always happening. So that's why the earworm was really interesting to him. It was a kind of I that is not I, a self that's coming from the outside in.
In their letters back and forth over their lives, Darwin eventually writes about how he's losing his ear for music, or how he's lost his ear for music. And he doesn't really write about music that much anymore, especially in his later years. How did this perception of him losing his sense of music, his ear for music, change about what he thought about the world and change about his own theories of evolution?
I think that the fact that he claims to have lost his sense for music, it both affected his theory of music and evolution and was affected by his theory of music and evolution, because he eventually abandoned his efforts to theorize about music. He wrote to his daughter, Henrietta, you know, midway through his career, "I'm writing about music and evolution in my new book, Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, but I really have nothing interesting to say, and I fear that I won't, you know, I won't be able to finish, or I won't be able to say anything of interest." And he left the matter ultimately to more musical thinkers like Spencer. And so he gave up on the idea of music and evolution. It was too tricky for him. And another reason why I think it's interesting that people try to reclaim him now is because even he wasn't totally convinced by his theory of music. So for one reason or another, he stopped thinking or writing about music and evolution. And I think that over the course of his life, he, in his mind anyway, created a sharp division between science and art. And he really leaned into the science side of things. That was his specialty. That was where he was getting attention. That was what he was known for, what he was comfortable with. And as he became more and more scientific, he claimed, that these are his words, that his mind became a machine for grinding out facts. and he lost his musical taste and interest. So, and he thought of this as kind of a sad thing. He missed his youthful exuberance for music and sort of bemoaned the fact that he didn't feel as drawn to it anymore and wished that he could rebuild it or reclaim it. And maybe if he had written one more thing about music and evolution, we would know what the connection there was and what he finally thought about it. But unfortunately, that's really the end of the story for Darwin and music. He eventually thought of himself as not a musical thinker.
What can you tell me about doing this research and writing this book? How did it inform your own thoughts about music? I know that in addition to an author and a lecturer and a music theorist, you're also a musician. So did going through these letters and this correspondence from the 19th century and researching these ideas and how they are interpreted up into the 21st century, has that informed your own process in creating art?
Absolutely, it has. And here's the truth of it. When I first started this work, I was really undecided about what the future of my research career would be. I wasn't sure if this book would be a stepping stone to more studies of music and evolution. Now that I've finished this project, and now that I've written what I wrote in the conclusion especially, I probably will not continue working on music and evolution. I personally do not think that evolutionary science is the right method for theorizing music. It's too distal a theory, and by that I mean it's too big. If you want to define music according to evolution, then you have to have a very narrow definition of what music is. You have to have a testable definition of what music is. I say in the book that evolutionary theories of music are ontologies of music. They are telling us, or they involve a process of ontologizing music or deciding what it is. For me, as an artist, maybe not even as a musician, I found that very creatively stultifying, thinking about music as something that must adhere to one or another evolutionary theory. And the conclusion that I came to is that I don't know what the origins of music are. I don't know what the function of music is. I do not yet know what music can be. And for me as an artist, that's much more creatively fulfilling and freeing than adhering to an evolutionary account.
UMass Amherst music theorist Miriam Pelinen speaking about her book, Theorizing Music Evolution, published by Oxford University Press. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In 2024, The Best of Our Knowledge welcomed associate producer Madeline Reynolds. Madeline's favorite interview of the last year was with glass artist Robert Degrenier. For the last several years, Degrenier has partnered with the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center in Vermont to celebrate children's imaginations through Glasstastic, where drawings of imaginary characters are transformed into 3D blown glass sculptures. Here's a portion of their conversation.
With the many drawings that are submitted, what makes you pick one maybe over the other to bring to life?
One just speaks to you. They usually ask us to do two or three because we're looking through, you know, four or five binding notebooks of drawings, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of drawings. And, you know, one will just speak to you. I know the first year I chose a dragon, which had all these parts and bits and fire coming out of the mouth, which was pretty much impossible to do with glass blowing. So I did kind of learn my lesson the first year. I did achieve something. It wasn't as great or that I was as proud of, but the child loved it. But that definitely, when I'm looking at the drawings, I'm also thinking about, really, is it possible? How big of a challenge is this going to be? So there's a little bit of influence there, just knowing the techniques that we use in glassmaking.
I would love for you maybe to describe some of the techniques that you do use in glassmaking.
Great. So we're working, there's many different ways to blow glass, or to make glass. The techniques that some of us are using is called offhand blowing. So you have a furnace of molten glass, and you're gathering glass on rods out of it, out of the furnace, and you're manipulating it with various tools, and you're reheating it, you're adding color, you're adding bits, and it's something that the glass has to be above 960 degrees the whole time you're making it. If it cools below that, the chances of the glass fracturing are huge, or falling off one of the pipes that you have. So it's a challenge, and you can't like put it away and then bring it out again and work on it. So it can take anywhere from a half an hour to 2 hours to perfect the piece that you're working on. And then once it has the feeling and character that we're trying to achieve from the child's drawing, it goes into what's called an annealing oven, and that's held at 960 degrees and slowly cools down over 18 hours. So the inside and the outside of the glass is the same temperature every degree it goes down. And that anneals the glass, it aligns all the molecules up properly, and there's no stress in it, so it doesn't crack. If we just left it out to air cool, it would explode within like 5 or 10 minutes. There are other glass workers that use a lamp glass, which is they're melting the glass with a torch on a bench. And there's various glasses that you can use. And one is borosilicate glass, which is the glass like Pyrex that our coffee pots are made. And you can put it on a hot stove and it's not going to crack. So that you can work and cool and add bits. You can get a lot finer detail with a fine torch and fine colors, much finer than you can with the offhand glass blowing. There's also another type of glass, which is a soda-lime glass that the flame workers use also, which is softer. It's a little more challenging than the Pyrex, but it also creates a very similar effect and incredibly realistic. I mean, some of the artists that are in the show, their own personal work, one guy does these amazing insects, tiny little legs. I mean, they're just absolutely exquisite, all made out of glass. And so there's inspirations. I'm sure they're looking at the drawings and they're looking at something that might be a little more delicate and fine detailed than some of the offhand glass blowers would use.
That's glass artist Robert Dugrenier speaking with our Madeline Reynolds. The 2025 Glass-tastic exhibition at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center in Vermont will be on display beginning in March. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1787. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.